Bonjour, bonjour, and welcome to another episode of EveryoneHatesMarketers.com, the marketing podcast for marketers, founders, and tech people who are just sick of shady, aggressive marketing. I'm your host, Louis Grenier. In today's episode, you will learn how to set up a one-year strategic marketing plan so you can get shit done with your team and lead your team effectively as well. We are not necessarily only going to talk about a one-year strategic marketing plan. We'll also talk about marketing strategy in general and how to lead a team with this. So my guest today comes from a company I really deeply admire, and I don't say that lightly, Buffer, which is, you know, the social scheduling platform who are very well known for their transparency. So they are the reason why I actually started a remote consulting company a few years ago that failed, but that's another story, and why I'm working remotely right now, actually, with Hotjar. That's when I discovered that companies like Buffer were working remotely. So my guest started as a content writer, and I've worn many hats since then, product marketer, partnership, social copywriter and manager, and he's now the director of marketing for Buffer, managing a team of 10 people. And Buffer is a company receiving more than 1 million visits a month on their blog, which is quite an impressive feat. So, Kevin Lee, welcome aboard.
Thank you, Louis. Great to be here.
So everyone talks about strategy, right? I mean, I read it almost on every single blog post or blog I visit. Like, people talk about this one strategy you should use to growth hack your success, or, you know, three strategies you should use tomorrow to do X, Y, and Z. So without giving too much about my opinion about the word strategy and what it actually means, I'd like to hear from you. What does it mean to you, strategy?
Yeah, one of my teammates put it quite succinctly for me once in this analogy. She said that we're trying to decide the difference between vision and strategy and tactics, because oftentimes we use these words interchangeably, or people assume one thing and someone else says another. And the analogy she uses is that the vision is where you're going, the strategy is how you're going to get there, and the tactics are the turn-by-turn directions. And that was very clarifying for me. I'm able to now filter those words into like a nice tidy box. So yeah, strategy for me is, if you already figured out where you're going to go, strategy is how you're going to get there. So as part of my role, I both need to figure out where we're going and how we're getting there. And then I like to pass along the tactics, the what, to the team itself. So yeah, strategy is kind of the car we're driving, or the route we're taking to get to our destination.
And it's as much as where you're going, it's also where you're not going and what you're not going to do, right?
Exactly. Yes, exactly.
So when we think of marketing strategy, so you summarize it quite well and quite simply. So vision is where you're planning to go. Strategy is how you're going to get there. And
correct.
Tactics are, repeat, so that's
the turn-by-turn directions.
The turn-by-turn directions, exactly. Right. And so when we think about it, it's a kind of an empty word to a lot of people. And it's like, why is it needed? Why do we even need to set up a marketing strategy when we lead a marketing team, or a strategy when you lead a business? Like, why is it important for you in your role to have a marketing strategy?
Yeah, that's a good one. So I came up through the tactics. Like, I started as a writer for our blog, and so I was very much in the day-to-day details. And having been in that world for many years, I know how easy it is to get tunnel vision and just to be very consumed by the work and not be able to pick your head up and see, oh, where do we actually end up? I picture it like you're tunneling through the ground, and like you could be the world's best tunneler, but if you never stick your head out of the tunnel, and you know, might not know if you're actually headed in the right direction or not. So strategy is having this, is how we're going to get there. Vision is where we're going. Like, having these components, it helps make the work feel more purposeful, makes the work feel like you're headed on the right track. Ideally, there's these outcomes that you want to achieve. And on the day-to-day basis, they could be an outcome of, you know, ship a blog post or write this email. But bigger picture, like, a vision could be to change the world for remote workers, or teach someone a skill they didn't have before. And then how to get there is maybe choosing which channels to go into, like these bigger decisions. And it all kind of trickles down into the work that you're doing on a day-to-day basis. So without that strategy, without that vision, I guess some of the work feels a bit aimless. And I didn't realize that until I was figuring out strategy and vision, like the actual importance of that kind of stuff.
So tell me more about this, because I can feel there is a turning point in your career where you switch from being very tactical to having to think strategically, right? Especially as a writer. I mean, I don't want to insult you, but I know from experience talking with a lot of writers, they probably don't have a lot of time to think strategy. You know, they have to deliver a blog post every single day, right? So when did you discover that setting up strategy, setting a vision was really important?
I think I'm still in the process of reminding myself that it's important. To a degree, strategy kind of feels like one of those, I guess strategy feels somewhat a bit more art than science, which I struggle with both art and science. I prefer like very, very tangible things. So science is a bit more tangible to me, I guess. You can quantify it, you can measure it. Yeah. So strategy is kind of an ongoing debate within myself. It's like what impact is this strategy actually having? And spending time thinking about strategy is so hard to prioritize when there's so much other work to be done. And so that's a huge struggle that I have. It's like, oh, how can I spend a week talking and thinking about strategy when I could have been spending a week writing this or putting this campaign together or measuring this or that or the other thing? So I have to remind myself that, you know, 1 week of strategy setting makes a huge difference for the 10 people I manage. It makes a huge difference for the work they do for the whole year. And so it's a different way of measuring productivity, I guess, when you are at the strategic level, because you don't get the feedback right away. You don't get that feeling, that dopamine rush of hitting send or publish on something. So I get that it's important. It's still very hard to prioritize and feel good about actually spending the time doing it.
So when did you start actually, when was the first time you went through this exercise of setting up a strategy for your team?
Let's see. I've been directing the team for a couple of years now. Honestly, when I started leading the team, I don't think I did strategy for several months. I think I looked to other people in the company to set marketing strategy for me, or I just stayed on the same marketing strategy that we had before and just stayed on that same path. So it probably took me maybe even a year into the lead role to actually sit down and think, oh, I need to actually be thinking about the strategy that we have. Does it make sense for us still to be doing content marketing after so many years? Like, I didn't even realize you could reach a ceiling on content marketing, and should I even be considering this kind of thing? So all these questions I didn't even know to ask and obviously didn't know the answers to at the time. Yeah, I'd say it took about a year before I was fully on board with strategy. I mean, I'm not on board with it yet. A year to start getting on board, to buy my ticket for it.
What was the process for you? What was the way you set out to say, okay, you know what, we're going to have a strategy for Buffer in like 2017, 2018, and we're going to do X, Y, and Z. How did you do that?
Yeah, I think like you said at the opening, you can hear a lot of advice out there for you should do this strategy or you should try this thing and you should be doing this type of work. And that's absolutely true. There's so many different templates out there to look at and companies to emulate. And one of the things that I've tried to do in my life and career, it's a parenting philosophy that I've adopted to a marketing philosophy, is that you never should on your kids and you never should on your marketers or your plans. And so whenever I hear that word should, it's always a trigger for me, like, oh, like I don't, like should is, I don't ever want to feel like I should have to do anything. It should be a choice. It should be me figuring it out on my own. So that was kind of how I went the strategy route. Like there's a lot of different templates to follow. I looked at many of them. Some of them were like, this is the way that you should be doing it. And I challenged that notion a little bit, and maybe immaturely I pushed back at being told what to do in some ways. So like I wasn't going to go that route. And then I stumbled across this one. It's one that's been pretty useful for us. It's a 1-year strategic marketing plan. And it was originally from a guy named David Cummings, and just kind of took his template and ran with it. And it was, honestly, it was useful for someone who hadn't had a background in strategy to have a template to follow. I think that made it more, it felt like I was shipping something at the end, like I could follow a blueprint and feel like I had done something by the end of it rather than just sitting there and thinking, oh, maybe this is strategy. So the template helped a lot, especially the first time around.
So I think in the next few minutes, what we're going to do is we're going to go through this template and trying to look back at the time where you set up a strategy for Buffer, how you went about it, maybe the mistakes you learned from it, and how you would, you know, tell listeners how to do the same exercise, right? Like trying to really go about it step by step. What should you do first? So maybe you can run through the template you use in terms of the different items that are there briefly, and then we can dive into how you actually agreed on each of them, because I suppose it's not chronological. You don't follow each one by one. You don't do them definitely. One by one.
Yep, exactly. So the marketing plan, it has a few different sections. It starts with a purpose, and this is like the company team purpose, like why are you doing what you're doing? I guess it's a bit of vision in that sense. There's a core value section, so what values guide the work that you do, the target demographic for your product, the promise of your brand, like a 200 words on what the brand is, an elevator pitch, which is a bit longer. So let's get to go into a bit more detail. Basically, the pitch you give someone if you only have an elevator ride to convince them to use your product. And then some numbers. So a three-year target, where you want to be in 3 years, where you want to be at in the current year, and then goals and priorities. So you can break it down based on cycles or quarters, however you work with your team.
And perhaps could you give us an example from Buffer? Maybe not all the ones, but at least I would say the purpose, core values, target demographic. I think people would, because most listeners I know of Buffer, probably would be nice to put that in perspective. So what's Buffer's purpose at the minute?
Yeah, so the purpose is to give people a greater voice on social media. At the minute, the purpose has shifted a little bit to be to help small businesses grow. So it's somewhat of an aspirational idea that you want to get at, a bit bigger than maybe the exact benefit of using the product. So we kind of try to zoom out a little bit when it comes to the purpose setting.
And then your values, I suppose. I remember you updated your values recently, even posted it on the blog. So what are kind of like your top three values, would you say?
Yeah, for the values exercise, we're lucky that the company has a set of values too. So we could have just cribbed off of those. That would have been nice and fast and easy. But basically we took those and we said, well, what is, given this template, this foundation of values, how do we conduct our work? Like, what is it? What difference does it look like within our marketing team? And so we ended up with a few. We had high quality work. We had honest, authentic, a few others. And then a big key for us is always do the right thing for our customers and community. So maybe an overall guide would be empathy is probably the theme of the values there.
And then your target demographic, because you said, yeah, you're switching a bit from to help small businesses grow. Recently, you expanded your offering with like Buffer Reply or Respond. Was it which one?
Yes. Used to be called Respond. Now it's called Reply. Yep.
Oh, okay. That's
fine. So a little bit of both.
Yep. So what target demographic did you pick just for your own strategy?
Yeah. So we ended up with small businesses. We also cater a bit to personal brands. So we're in the midst of choosing a target customer, like company-wide at the moment. So for the most part, it's small businesses. And then we're going to be more specific in the coming months about what we mean when we say small businesses.
Right. I'm just going to run through the items again, and then we'll try to go through the exercise of filling those out, right, together and step by step. So the purpose, the core values, target demographic, the brand promise, the elevator pitch, the three-year target, the annual goals, the quarterly, monthly, and cycle goals, and the priority projects. So as I mentioned, it doesn't sound like we fill this one pager one item at a time, right? It sounds more like you fill the gaps here and there together. There might be some steps that are not that simple when you're starting out. So how would you advise listeners to actually fill this page and potentially using your own experience? Where do you start? What is step number one?
Yes. Well, the very first time I did this, I did go top to bottom and just like fill it in like a Mad Lib. So it was maybe not the easiest or the best way to go about it. I would say step one is to figure out the purpose, kind of figure out the vision, purpose, vision, that bigger idea.
How do you go about it?
It's an excellent question. It typically comes from the company itself. So this purpose that is on our sheet is basically our company vision. So very easily, I just copied it from our company vision. If you're leading a marketing team, hopefully you're part of those conversations and can shape it at the company level. And then it's basically fill in the blank when it comes to the marketing.
And let's say you're not the marketer, the marketing director, you're actually the CEO or C-suite, and you need to figure out a purpose that doesn't sound fluffy yet that is inspirational enough. Do you have any tips like to help people figure that out?
Yeah, I can give you another exercise. So we do use this marketing one pager still, and we've also added what's called a vision framework, and it comes from Jim Collins. And it has a bunch of different elements to it. It has core purpose, core values, so some of the similarities to our one pager. But it also has something called vivid description and BHAG. And the BHAG stands for big, hairy, audacious goals. And in the course of going through this vision framework, there's questions to get you thinking about, okay, what gets you excited in the morning? Like what kind of work could you be doing that even if you weren't paid for it, you'd still be doing? Or once this job goes away, what kind of work will you still be doing after this job? And so it really gets at the things that you're personally passionate about. I think at that CEO, founder, personal brand level, entrepreneur level, a lot of the work that you do probably has to have some element of that in order for it to be work that you can be excited about and be excited about while you're putting in all the work to make the thing work. So we use that vision framework exercise. We did it earlier this year and it was super useful, especially the vivid description part where you kind of describe what your company wants is going to look like in 5, 10, 15 years and we wrote a press release. I wrote a New York Times article.
Of course.
A fake New York Times article. just to kind of see what life would be like if all of our dreams come true, and then you work backward from there.
Yeah, and that's something I discovered from you actually a few months ago when I stumbled upon your profile again. That really was a nice thing to see. So this exercise is basically, as you said, it could be a press release set in the future, it could be an article in the New York Times, but it's really about the things you've accomplished, the things you want to accomplish in the next 5, 10, 20 years. And it might sound fluffy, but actually works really well to focus on what matters the most. And it's quite interesting. And I never worked on the vivid description thing, but I did work on my purpose quite a lot for the podcast and why I'm doing it. And I finally managed to go through like a purpose that is simple enough. And I can say it in 3 words. And I love to say it every time I can, which is I fight marketing bullshit and I love it. And it doesn't really say where I'm going, but I think there's going to be enough marketing bullshit out there for the next 50 years that I think I'll still be trying to fight it. But to go back to the exercise then, so how did you go about doing this vivid description? You said you wrote it, but how did you meet with your team? Did you have 3 calls with your team? How did you go about understanding that this is actually where I want to go as a team?
I did 0 calls with my team, which in hindsight might have been the wrong move. Basically, my approach to it was, I feel like I have a very strong intuition of knowing what Buffer is about, what my team values, what historically what we have done, what's worked for us. And given that information, I felt pretty solid about moving forward with it. So I went through the vision framework exercise all by myself. And after I had done it, I shared it with our CEO. And he and I spent a couple of weeks on it, but truly it was asynchronous. It was, he would look at it one day and I would look at it the next day for, 15 minutes each. So total, maybe a couple hours together on it. And the reason why I did it and then went up to the CEO with it is because it needs to be aligned with our company, our overall company direction. If marketing is headed off in one direction and product is headed off in a different direction, things aren't going to work. So we had to be pointed in the same direction. And then I kind of feel like I'm close enough to my team that I know, this sounds super egotistical, but I know what they think and where their heart's at. And so it was a pretty easy sell once I was done with it from that higher level. And then I shared it with them and got their thoughts and, not much change there because it was all pretty good to go.
From someone who probably doesn't have the intuition that you have, because that's not a trait that a lot of people have, right? Or someone who maybe works on their business on their own or have a small team. So how do you advise people to actually come up with this kind of vivid description about where you're going to go as a company, what you're going to accomplish?
Yeah, I think in the way that the framework works, you start with your purpose and your values. And then from there, the vivid description fills out. So definitely start by understanding where you want to go and what's going to guide you, what values are going to guide you to get there. And then a lot of it for me was what would be exciting for us as a team? What would make a real difference in the world? What would making good on this purpose look like? If we were to, for instance, let's say we want to give people a greater voice on social media. Well, what does that actually look like? Well, it could look like a lot of different things. It could be small businesses find new channels and that everyone becomes a social media expert in a way, or we're able to give that to them. And then what does that look like? It means maybe we build out a whole library of courses and we are the go-to social media educator. Then, education. Well, maybe that could mean we get certified courses or we start some higher education programs where we're actually training people. And if you think training people, oh, cool. Maybe we're actually putting people into these jobs. We're having internship programs. And it spirals pretty quickly, as you can tell. There's lots of different directions to take it. I would encourage you just to go down those routes and kind of see, if we were to explore this, what would that look like? What could this look like? And then if that sounds like an exciting path, then figure out, what would it take to get there? That's kind of the basis I work towards. So our vivid description had things like, we're going to build out an editorial team. And then my mind went to, oh, cool, it'd be fun to have a magazine someday. Like, that would be cool and innovative. And so the magazine's in there and all these different things. You don't have to do them all, but just the actual process of dreaming big and thinking big that informs the strategy that you set in order to get there. And you can check that strategy every so often and see, is it still the path you want to be on? Is it still the way you want to go?
There's something quite similar. I'm just remembering now, and I'm actually having to Google it because I'm not going to remember the name of the book. I'm going to find it in the next few seconds. Mm-hmm. But I read it. That's actually Seth Godin who recommended this book on this podcast. And it's about this art teacher, I think, or music teacher. At the start of every year, he makes his students write a letter to themselves that they'll have to open again in 1 year. But like the exercise of like writing a letter to yourself, to saying, you know, dear future, or I think it's more like dear past myself, like in 1 year, mm-hmm. I would have done X, Y, and Z, I've achieved this, da, da, da. And the moral of the story is that through this exercise, these students would keep going to class, these students would be super engaged, and they would be much more willing to participate, much more willing to have good grades and all of that, just through this exercise. So I think it's something quite powerful for people's brain. I'm going to find the name, The Art of Possibility.
Yeah.
That's the name.
That's great.
Yeah, so it's a great book. And I think it goes back to the storytelling part of our brain. It goes back to the fact that we need vivid description of things. We need stories. We need things like that we can imagine in our head. To be engaged. And I think that connects very well with that. So this vivid description, we're spending a bit of time on it, but I think it's absolutely critical. As you said, if you don't know where you're going to go, then all the rest doesn't really matter.
Yeah. It's an interesting concept too. I've done some counseling before and like therapy and coaching, and I've been involved in these processes. I haven't done it like I've given coaching to people. I've been coached and I've been counseled and things. And often I will have like these types of exercises will come up in that kind of setting too, where, you know, picture your ideal day. What does it look like? And then knowing that, how do you get there? What can you change today that will get you closer to that ideal day? Where do you want to be in 5 years and 10 years in life? And then work backwards from there. So I noticed that I have quite a, I think idealism is one of my personality traits. I took a test once that told me that. So I feel like I have no problem thinking up ideal things and working toward that. And I think it's a useful trait to have when it comes to vivid description and kind of vision setting stuff.
And in fact, that reminds me of when I started my consulting business. I actually had printed pictures of my family, pictures of the future house I want to own, and a few things like this. So just planning out for the future, like you're waking up for this, you know? And actually, I looked at it back a few months ago and realized that I've accomplished almost everything in there without actively thinking about it, without like saying, you know, every day looking into it. But it just naturally happens when you're very clear on where you want to go. Like the universe has a way to like bring you to this path. Obviously, it's not the universe. Let's be clear, it's you as working on it every day. But unconsciously, your brain has understood that this is where I want to go, and you're taking the right decisions then based on that, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, and it's similar if you take it down a level. I think we've seen this with a concept called scoreboarding, which is basically if your team has a goal, make that goal visible. So show it in Slack once a day and everyone looks at it, put it in the front of your Trello board, put it, if you're in an office, stick it on the office wall or make a screen that has the progress on it. And just seeing that number and seeing that outcome is, you're right, like subconsciously you're aware of it and working toward it even when you're not consciously, even if you don't know you're doing it. So absolutely.
So that's for the kind of the inspirational, the purpose, the goal setting, the big picture thinking. And the next part of the template is a bit more, should I say, tactical, a bit more grounded in facts and grounded in science, should I say. So the target demographic, the brand promise, the elevator pitch, the three-year target. So how did you go about setting those up for Buffer, especially the target demographic? People do seem to struggle a lot with that in picking the right audience and the targets and all of this jazz. So how did you go about it?
Yeah, so the target demographics, some of that comes from our product research team. We can just kind of take their findings. I'd say if you don't have a product research team, some of the stuff we've done in the past is to survey our customers or survey our audience, find out some common demographics that they share. If you can get even more specific, you can kind of put those folks into different cohorts and then see, you know, this cohort here of maybe small business owners, like what kind of revenue do they bring in on average? What's their lifetime value? What's their acquisition cost? You can bucket them in terms of which ones actually are successful using the product and those become your target customers. So that's one way of doing it. When it comes to the 3-year targets, you're getting like all my dirty secrets of how I kind of wing some of this stuff. Like a 3-year target for us is basically, well, what do we do in 1 year and multiply it by 3 and maybe add a little bit so it looks good. You know, like I have no process beyond that. Like our 3-year target is have 250,000 paying customers who find value in Buffer. And honestly, we have 80,000 today, and 80,000 times 3 is 240,000 plus a little bit. So that is the dark science behind setting targets.
Now, I appreciate your transparency coming from someone working for Buffer. I'm not surprised. But there you have it. I think it's overcomplicating those kind of things can really slow you down, right? And it sounds like from your answers, you're not, even though you are taking those seriously, it's important to have those goals. It seems like you are taking other things more seriously, such as, you know, how to get things done every day, how to make sure that your team is happy, how to make sure they're productive, how to make sure that they feel empowered to do stuff, right? I just want to go back to what you said about target demographic, because we talked about it a lot on this podcast, right? How to identify your ideal buyer and customer research. We talked about it many times. One thing I haven't shared on the podcast yet is to look at the RFM methodology, which is used in e-commerce mainly, but it works really well for other stuff, which is recency, frequency, and monetary value. So basically, looking at people who bought the most recently from you, who bought the most often from you, and who bought the most from you, right? And usually when you look at the intersection of the three, that comes the ideal buyer persona, the ideal buyer profile. And I mean, I don't want to make overly like generalize everything, but most of the time it's like the Pareto law, or even worse, it's like those 20% of customers make 80% of your revenue. So I would definitely recommend people to do that first before they pick a target audience that is very vague. Now, as a business like Buffer, you mentioned, you know, small business is your target audience. I would say that most companies can't and shouldn't pick such a broad audience until they are at the scale that Buffer is, right? They really need to focus on a very, very small amount of people first.
I think that's very fair to say. Yep.
So moving on to the 3-year target that you basically, the formula is you multiply by 3, whatever big goal you have.
Yes.
And then annual goals, I suppose you also draw a line and you start looking at, okay, working backwards. Okay.
Pretty much.
I can get
you multiply a monthly target by 12. Yeah.
So, I'm more curious then about the things you decide to do and the things you decide not to do. Because I think that's the meaty part of the strategy. It's like, as I mentioned in the intro, it's like it's as important to say we are not going to do this that it is to say we are going to do this. So in Buffer and in general, how would you advise people to select the right thing to do and not going overboard? Or how do you advise people to do that?
Yeah, when I think of saying no to things and saying yes to things, I think there's a couple reasons to say no. The first is we say no to anything that's not within our values. So having that value statement up top is a great place to start. That'll eliminate some options right away. Then the second thing, like I think you alluded to, is that time element of like, there's so many different things to try. Why choose this over this? Or what if you try to do it all? And that's definitely not a good recipe too. So I'd say if you're just getting started, one thing that we found really useful is the bullseye exercise, which is from the book Traction. And it's basically an exercise that runs you through, I guess, 19 or 20 very popular, common, useful different tactics and channels. And it helps you identify which one has the biggest potential, which one will work for you initially. And that should get you going with a couple of channels. And that's a great place to start. And then I joined the Buffer marketing team at a point in time when content marketing was already quite established for us. And so I stepped into that role and was able to keep it going. And now we have a few established channels. We have content, we have PR, we have community, and those ones are in social media, and they do great for us. And so we've shifted now. So we want to continue to do great things there, but we also want to expose ourselves to new opportunities. And, you know, maybe there is a new strategy out there that could work, and we want to validate that or invalidate that. And so we take this 70-30-10 approach, where 70% of our time and resources are dedicated to the channels that we know are working, where 30% are dedicated to exploring new channels that have been validated by others and we think might have potential. and then spend 10% just doing wild and crazy stuff. And that has helped us say no to certain things and say yes to other things. I think it's helped. I mean, we don't say no to certain things. I guess we limit our time so there's only a chance to do the work on certain things, you know, 30%, 10% of the time. But anything is still out there and a possibility. It's just we've boxed ourselves and only have some constraints about how much time to spend with that kind of stuff.
So I had to do the math, though. So that's 110% in total. So is it...
Oh, it is, isn't it? Is it's 60-30-10.
60-30-10, cool.
Thank you.
And of course. So, and there you have it. I think for Buffer's case, you are known to have grown using content mainly. I mean, am I right to say that content marketing is still the number one driver of new signups?
Yeah, our number one driver is word of mouth, and then search, and then content marketing. Yep.
But search comes from content, right?
It comes from
mostly.
It comes from content and word of mouth. Yeah, like people searching right. Buffer and coming to us from there. Yeah.
Yeah, branded search and branded search. Yep. The reason why I'm coming to that is like, I would also, based on the book Traction, that is a great book, I would also advise, especially if you're starting out or even in established business, to focus your attention on those one or two channels, one or two key projects that will, should deliver the most yield for your business, right? And avoiding picking 10 channels and try every single one of them and say none is working, right? I mean, in this day and age, competition is fierce. There's a lot going on. If you try one thing for a week, like content for a week, and think it's not working, we're not going to do that, it's going to fail. So how do you pick then those top projects, those top activities that should be like crucial for your business?
Yeah, we always try to start with a minimum viable test. So if there's something that you think is worth trying, then what's the smallest scoped project that will get you results that you can base a decision off of? So let's say if it's content marketing you're exploring, rather than going out and starting a blog and giving it 6 months to see if you reach certain goals, you might try guest posting one or two places, or you might start a Medium publication and, you know, post from grab other folks' contributions. So it's less of a time commitment or cost for you up front. So start small, know what will be a significant result for you, and then test against that result. Another way of doing it is observing what's working for others in your space, because it's almost like learning what they have already validated. There's risk in that, of course, of, you know, you're kind of borrowing tactics and potentially flooding the market with similar type stuff and just jumping into a place that's very competitive already. But that is a way to shortcut it a little bit if you see stuff working. You can also look outside your own industry, for instance, outside your own market. So for us, we might not copy what Hootsuite and Sprout Social are doing. We might look to a company like Intercom or like Hotjar or someone else that's, you know, a tech startup or a marketing tool, but is not a social media marketing tool. And we can borrow tactics from there and know that they've already been validated to a degree. So there's a couple of different ways to make the starting process a bit shorter.
And what about the skills that you might have or the interests that you might have? How do you factor that in into testing new things?
Yeah, that's a good one. I think for marketers, it's almost a requirement now that you are quite generalist with a lot of skills, especially if you're a marketer on a smaller team. Or if you're not a generalist with a lot of skills, that you're open to learning quickly or you're open to finding solutions quickly. So we try not to limit ourselves based on the skills that we have on the team. We try to approach it from a mindset of if this is effective and if we think it might be effective, let's gain those skills, let's learn those skills and figure it out. So for instance, we don't have anyone on the team who's really good with, who's an ads expert. We don't really do much in terms of ads, but we wanted to explore that channel recently. And so we had someone on the team who was very good at jumping into something brand new and learning it. We had him jump into that and learn it and get like a base level understanding of whether this channel makes sense for us or not. And it worked.
Nice.
I mean, the channel didn't work, but he worked in figuring it out for us. Yeah.
Yeah. Ads are getting more and more expensive. And so for this year, then, what are the top three plans for Buffer?
Yeah. So we're in this kind of cool season of marketing life at Buffer where we're doing some really big foundational things to our product. And we're excited to get to the point where we can start shouting about all that cool stuff that's happening there. And in the meantime, it's kind of a season of life for us where we can be the ones shipping stuff and launching things and making some noise. So engineering as marketing is one of the channels that you'll read about in the Traction book, but that's one that we are going to dig into a bit more in the coming months and hopefully ship some new tools and some new features, kind of like standalone things, standalone apps. We're definitely going to do more on the content side of things. It's going to look a bit different. So we have a podcast that's been growing pretty well. We have a new strategy on our blog. We're going to expand into a content library that people can go to for resources, turn the existing blog into more of a magazine publication style content. So that's a pretty exciting one for us. And then we're also exploring the referral, kind of the viral ambassador side of things. We technically are starting an ambassador program at the moment, but again, doing that minimum viable test route and seeing like if this idea makes sense or if we need to try a different type of idea. So we're in the process of discovering what that looks like for us.
Exciting. Switching gears now, because that sounds all nice. But I want to go back to your career in the past. And I know you've been sharing a few struggles, a few challenges with me already, which is nice. But like, if you had to pinpoint the biggest marketing fuck up of your career, like the one that you remember, like the big lesson you learned from that, and it can be like 3 months ago, it could be 6 years ago, what would it be?
Oh, I can think of a lot. A very small one. Wait, well, I don't know if it was small. I sent out our CEO's home address in the footer of an email to all of our customers once. That was not great. But his parents got a few notes, but that was all. I don't know if this one counts, but recently, like, this is a very, one of those strategy artsy things I don't really understand, but like not having the same strategy on the marketing side or not interpreting strategy the same way on the marketing side as we do on like the product company side. So we recently went to a more of a funnel approach, or I guess a funnel approach to how we assign different metrics to different areas of the team. So we would, like the pirate funnel, for instance, marketing owns awareness and acquisition and product owns activation and retention and revenue. And I took that up very literally. So I was setting like number targets. And I mean, as you've heard how I set number targets, so like, I don't know how literally that actually was, but like mine was very numbers focused and theirs was more vision focused. And just that generic split, I recognize now as a mistake where I should have spent more time getting on the same page. I'll give you one more. I could keep going for a while, but one more was, I think in the content marketing days, I was deep in content marketing maybe four years ago. So things have changed a little bit since, but it was like, it's a competitive space when you're trying to grow a blog and get attention to your content. And there's a lot of less than ideal things that you can do to get the word out there. And so I did some things I'm not super proud of, like, you know, pitch guest posts and write guest posts solely for the purposes of a backlink. And I was very tempted to buy followers at one point just to like goose that. I was going to write a blog post about it. So like, I think I was technically like, I don't know, I felt my conscience felt okay since I was going to write about it, but just like these shortcuts, I think the shortcuts are always so tempting when it comes to these highly competitive channels. And I've definitely fallen for a couple before.
So tell me more, because that's part of the other question I wanted to ask you in terms of the sleazy, shady marketing tactics you might have used in the past. So pitching guest blogs so you can get a backlink, you would treat that as being sleazy. A lot of people would say that's quite smart. so I appreciate that. What other stuff, like buying followers as well, that's pretty sleazy, all right. What other things have you tried or thought of trying in this kind of dark area of marketing?
Yeah. Well, I'm lucky that, so we don't do sales at Buffer, and we don't really do lead capture, lead gen, lead nurture, lead scoring. We don't really do much with leads. So I'll just start off by saying that has probably spared me from lots of mistakes that would have been perfect for this section. There's lots of different lead things that can happen. But even with that, like I've either been tempted or I've done it. I'm sure I've done it. It's just not treating our email lists with a lot of respect, like treating them more as these transactional lemons to squeeze more and more out of. And that can take the form of a lot of different things. It can take the form of us running our list against our user list and finding which ones are not Buffer users and then kind of blasting them with CTAs with no real value add in that email. It can be using that list to try to send traffic to webinars or these co-marketed things that we are, this is really inside. So sometimes you might have noticed this from our chat, like I'm not a super pushy person, or at least I don't think I'm a super pushy person. And so when I'm connected with someone who's pushy, like I'm a people pleaser, like I want to please them. And so maybe like 3 years ago, you would have received an email from me asking you to sign up for a webinar solely because I wanted to please this other person that I was working with on a webinar. I mean, in the grand scheme of things, it probably just felt like a normal webinar invitation, but like, that's not the right motivation to be sending emails to folks. Like I'm trying to meet a quota for someone else that doesn't even work at Buffer. So that, there's a few. I can keep going if you want, but yeah, maybe I'll...
Give me another one.
Give you another one. Okay. Well, let's see. So we would... I don't know if this wasn't black hat at the time or bad at the time, but we would heavily promote our blog posts on Twitter and other social media. Like I think the ratio, and we talked about this on the blog, the proper ratio of promoting content on your social media feeds is like, let's say 9 of everyone else's content to every 1 piece of your content. And we fully did it backwards. We did 1 of everyone else's and 9 of ours, which worked and was great. And we wrote about it and told people, like, try this out. I don't know if I regret saying that or if like I'd fully backtrack on it, but like looking back now, I can see like that wouldn't fit the strategy that we have at the time, like we have at the present day for our social media accounts. It might've made more sense back in the day when, you know, social media was a bit different, but just that very nature of flipping things to be so self-promotional, I think is a thing I would not do today. I'd hope I wouldn't do it today.
Well, I can definitely put you in the white hat marketing section or box, should I say, because all the stuff you shared, yeah, they're probably gray hat. But even then, I would say
not that bad.
They're all right, you know, like I can.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah, I can tell you a few other things we've seen. Yeah, there's just plenty of other black hat, sleazy, aggressive tactics out there. And the ones you mentioned are definitely not that much out there. They're not
like, clear my conscience then.
Yeah, they're not like good marketing per se. They're not like the perfect good marketing. They're not terrible either. But anyway, thanks for sharing all of those, because that was quite insightful to understand more of who you are and why you're doing certain things. You seem to have a very good understanding of who you are as a person. Maybe that explains like the mention you went, like you did coaching, counseling before, and it sounds like you probably got a lot of insight out of those. I don't want to extrapolate. So maybe that's something that would you encourage people and listeners to get a coach, to talk to someone, a therapist, a counselor?
Absolutely. Yeah, I was really lucky too. And this could be, you know, if you don't want to go that route, just like having management be a key thing for your company. I was really lucky to have a wonderful manager when I started at Buffer and taught me a ton of different things about life and marketing and all this stuff. And I continue to be managed really well. And I think I've learned that myself, that I take it very seriously, the privilege of managing other people. So sometimes I may treat my manager as a therapist in some ways, which he might not like, but there's also going outside the company for therapy or coaching. Just like self-awareness is so important, I think, in life and in marketing too. It helps you understand yourself, and it also helps you empathize with others.
Yeah, absolutely. I concur. I talked to a counselor recently about my anxiety that I suffer from kind of off and on, and definitely helps. And I know not everyone has the means to pay for a therapist or a counselor, but I would encourage if you're feeling stressed, anxious, depressed, to talk about it to someone, whoever it is, right? Family, colleague, friend, because that helps a lot. So switching gears to something a bit less serious, should I say, but what do you think marketers should learn today that will help them in the next 10 years, 20 years, 50 years?
Yeah. In terms of like hard skills, I think we talked a bit about this idea of being a generalist, or at least being having a growth mindset when it comes to trying new things. So that's a super key mental state to be in. Specifically when it comes to skills, I think skills like basic HTML, CSS is something great to know at this stage. If you want to get even deeper into coding, that can be a great skill to have as a marketer. Data analysis and understanding data at like a theoretical level, so that you're drawing the right conclusions from the data that you see, but also from, you know, maybe even learning SQL or learning some different data analysis techniques can be really useful. And then like the generic stuff too, like storytelling, writing, all those good things are great to have. And then to take it up a level, I'd probably say a couple of things that will set you up on a great path is to really bring empathy into the work that you do, and to think about the things that you're doing. How are they being received by others? Put yourself in someone else's shoes. Like, you yourself get tons of marketing coming your way all the time. Like you experience this stuff as a consumer. What feels good to you? What doesn't feel good to you? And kind of extrapolate that to the work that you do. And then it's interesting, the question about like, what will help you in 10 years? And it's almost want to answer with that question. It's like, if you think 10 years ahead, I think that is one of the most helpful things. If you're always thinking a bit more long-term, like for instance, I'm doing some very tactical work at the moment. I'm trying to grow one of our blogs, and I'm just like in it. Like my head is down. I have no idea what's happening all around me. And I'm going down these wormholes of like, oh, well, I'm never going to grow this because this thing isn't like this, and this isn't working, and let me try this. And then I need someone else to pull me out of it and just to think, oh, well, you know, you don't have to be checking the numbers daily, because they're not going to, like, who knows what conclusions you can draw from daily, check them daily, like check them monthly, check them every 14 days, like zoom out a little bit and see the aggregate of the work that you're doing. And that's been super helpful, just to have that longer term perspective, which I know not everyone has the luxury of doing that if you're needing to grow today. But if at all possible, pick your head up and look out can be really useful.
Yeah, absolutely. What are the top three resources you would recommend our listeners? Could be anything, like podcast, books,
anything. Yeah. From like a motivational standpoint, I like the concept of just doing the work. Like if you want to become a better marketer, if you want ways to grow, just start trying stuff, like get a side hustle, have a little sandbox that you can play around in. Then when it comes to the, like, tangible things, I'd say the Reforge website is great. It's a website run by Brian Balfour. The marketer marketing stuff is done by Susan Sue, and they have a great newsletter. They have great blog content, and they also have a like seasonal, maybe every twice a year course that you can apply to, which is great. There's an awesome book called Anything You Want by Derek Sivers, and it's kind of about like business building, but I took a lot of marketing insights from it. I think his approach is very unique and definitely has that empathy element to it. And there's a cool series called Forget the Funnel by Georgiana Lotti and Claire Sullentrop, and they are two wonderful friends and great marketers, and they have a really cool perspective that they bring to marketing too, which I think is close to yours, Louie, a bit of non-traditional marketing advice that it works and gets great results and feels good to everyone.
Yeah, it feels good to everyone. Yeah, I actually met Claire Sullentrop recently in Dublin. She went to the conference called Learn in Bern. I met her for coffee. I interviewed her on the podcast as well, and I was on the Forget the Funnel episode talking about marketing strategy actually a few months ago. So yes, I would recommend Forget the Funnel, absolutely. And the book you mentioned, can you repeat the title again, please?
Yes, Anything You Want by Derek Sivers.
Never heard of it, so I'll definitely check it out. Thanks so much for sharing those resources. Thanks also for being open and super transparent about the struggles and the mistakes you've made and the way you pick goals for your company and for the marketing. I really appreciate that. I know listeners would probably like that very much too. So before I let you go, where can listeners connect with you and learn more from you?
Yeah, so I have a website, kevanlee.com. It's K-E-V-A-N-L-E-E. And I'm on Twitter at Kevin Lee. You can message me on LinkedIn. And then I'm occasionally on our Buffer blogs. And you can go to buffer.com to find more about Buffer and about our content.
Well, Kevin, thank you so again for your time. And thanks for all of your insights.
Great. Thanks, Louie.
That's it for another episode of EveryoneHatesMarketers.com. And this is the moment where I tell you to subscribe to our email list. So before you leave and go to another podcast or listen to another episode, I don't treat email lists the way people usually treat their email list. I really treat that as a one-to-one conversation. So I'm going to send you very short and personal emails every 2 weeks, I would say. I'll inform you of guests in advance. I'll share with you my numbers and how many listens we get, and I'll also ask you for your feedback in terms of the questions we can ask future guests, and perhaps I can also have you on the show someday. So don't be afraid to subscribe. I'm not going to spam you, and you can always unsubscribe for sure if you wish. The second thing we need from you is your harsh and honest feedback. We know that this show is not perfect yet, and we always can improve. So you can send us your email at feedback@everyonehatesmarketers.com. Good or bad, please feel free to send me an email. And the last thing I'd like from you is that if you did like the episode, please share it to your friends, your colleagues, or whoever might like it. And also please review it on iTunes or another service that you might use to listen to your podcast. Because if you leave us a 5-star review, it means that more people will be likely to listen and we can spread the word quicker. So thank you so much once again, and au revoir.